Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. After 7 years holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange was dragged out yesterday and arrested. He faces a criminal charge in the U.S. for conspiracy to help a military analyst get illegal access to classified government documents. WikiLeaks editor-in-chief Kristen Ruffson said Assange committed no crime.
This is journalism. It's called conspiracy. It's conspiracy to commit journalism. So this has to end, and we urge everybody to support Julian Assange in fighting this extradition.
A major shakeup this week as President Trump ousted Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen and a bunch of other agency chiefs, frustrated that they aren't doing enough to tighten the border. Nielsen addressed reporters outside her home.
I share the president's goal of securing the border. I will continue to support all efforts to address the humanitarian and security crisis on the border.
And in Sudan, longtime President Omar al-Bashir was ousted in a coup by the military yesterday. Al-Bashir is a longtime autocrat accused of war crimes and genocide. Thousands of people packed the streets of Khartoum to protest against the army's announcement that al-Bashir would be replaced by a military-led transitional council. Join us. We'll be talking first a little bit about that arrest of Julian Assange. What questions do you have? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With us right now from London, Richard Engel. He's chief foreign correspondent for NBC News, also the host of On Assignment with Richard Engel. A new episode airs Sunday nights on MSNBC. Richard, great to have you.
It's a pleasure to be here. How are you?
Doing great. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, our own On Point news analyst Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David. Hello, Richard.
So let's start a little bit with Julian Assange. Tell us a little bit about the scene, Richard Engel, and tell us a little bit about the implications.
So it's an interesting story. I spent some of the day yesterday in front of the Ecuadorian embassy here in London. And 7 years ago, 7 years have passed. And until this story broke, I had forgotten how long it's been.
Yeah.
And when Julian Assange first went into that building, he was something of a hero in many circles, particularly in Europe. People thought that he was being persecuted because he had published materials that were embarrassing to the U.S. government, embarrassing to the U.S. military. And Ecuador decided to give him asylum. And he went inside the building, and then he never left. And The Ecuadorian president even yesterday said enough was enough. They had grown tired of him. They didn't like his behavior. They said he was rude. They in the past, they've complained about his personal hygiene, that he didn't pick up after his cat. You can imagine 7 years in one building, trapped there with other diplomats who have to do their work. So under tremendous international pressure, the British authorities were finally allowed in. The Ecuadorians stopped protecting Assange. They brought him out looking very pale, with his full beard, looking a little bit like Saddam Hussein after he'd been pulled out of that hole.
And I thought with the beard, he kind of looked like Letterman a little bit.
Letterman, Papa Smurf, Saddam Hussein. The British press, they're all there today.
Right.
And now they're trying to figure out what to do with him. Are they going to extradite him to the U.S.? Most likely, although some people here are saying that they should not.
Well, Jack Beattie, you know, it's interesting. He was in the embassy, if I recall correctly, because he's basically trying to avoid extradition to Sweden on charges that he might have sexually assaulted two women there. And one of the women, I think, was quoted saying that she stood by her allegations. But this obviously is swept up in the question of national security. Remind us a little bit about the role that over the past, you know, or well, I guess it was something like a decade, 12 years ago it started, and then really heated up in 2010 as well. the role that Assange played in our understanding of what the U.S. military and what U.S. Officials and officials of other countries were doing.
Well, yes, through Chelsea Manning, Bradley Manning at the time, a soldier at, stationed in Iraq, he gained access to, you know, multifarious documents in the thousands, documenting U.S. conduct in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Some of it was incendiary. We all remember there was a film clip showing a helicopter gunships, U.S. Helicopter gunships firing on Iraqi civilians. And in fact, there were reporters there, I believe, from the Associated Press or Reuters, and that had been denied. There were leaks about sources in informants in Afghanistan that might have been dangerous to them. There were leaks about diplomatic indiscreet comments of our diplomats about their host governments. A whole panoply of things. And but he's not being charged with that. He's not being charged with publication of secrets, rather with theft of secrets. He's being charged with essentially assisting Manning in stealing these secrets, these documents, not in publishing them. Now, his defense will be, wait a minute, you're trying to criminalize source protection here, someone said. He was trying to hide Manning's identity and
her ability to
break
get
a
into
code
a,
to do that. Yes,
exactly.
Yes,
and
that's just a traditional role of a journalist to hide the source's name. Yeah.
Right. And that's a very interesting dual thing. We have with us as well from Washington, Vivian Salama. She's the White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Vivian, as we talk about Julian Assange, I want to play for you a couple of clips back to back. First, on the 2016 campaign trail, candidate Donald Trump simply could not get enough of WikiLeaks. He told voters he loved WikiLeaks and he praised the group on the trail after it threw Hillary Clinton's campaign off course by publishing thousands of emails hacked from the Democrats. Trump was asked about that by reporters yesterday after Assange's arrest.
Do you still love WikiLeaks?
I know nothing about WikiLeaks. It's not my thing. And I know there is something having to do with Julian Assange. I've been seeing what's happened with Assange, and that will be a determination, I would imagine, mostly by the Attorney General, who's doing an excellent job. So he'll be making a determination. I know nothing really about him. It's not my deal in life.
WikiLeaks was a big deal in the life of Hillary Clinton, though. She spoke in New York last night. Her campaign thrown really awry, as I said, by some of the WikiLeaks postings of Democratic emails. When asked about Assange, she said Assange doesn't fall under the protections that should be granted to journalists who obtain confidential information.
It is clear from the indictment that came out. It's not about punishing journalism. It's about assisting the hacking of the military computer to steal information from the United States government.
Vivian Salama, Trump administration officials have wanted to prosecute Assange for a while. Are they trying to punish him as a journalist? Or are they trying to prosecute him because he may have broken a law in terms of helping Chelsea Manning get access to an account in terms of hacking a computer password?
Well, this is an ongoing debate within the Trump administration as far as, you know, legally where they can take this. Obviously, for President Trump, this also highlights his very complicated relationship with the intelligence community and the national security community at large, where on the one hand, you know, he kind of casts some doubt over what they do and the services that they provide to this country and whether or not the information that they collect can be trusted to a degree. And then on the other hand, you know, what we saw yesterday where he doesn't really want to own the you know, any actions that would somehow impact the work that they do. And so yesterday, you know, we really saw the president trying to distance himself from the activities of Julian Assange so that should the Department of Justice and other agencies decide to move forward with prosecution, should he be extradited, he would basically kind of keep a distance. But, of course, what we know from, several rallies and especially around the time of the Democratic National Convention, the Republican National Convention in 2016, where he really even shouted out that he'd love WikiLeaks to obtain some of Hillary Clinton's emails from the server. He obviously, back then at least, he knew what WikiLeaks was and he very much called upon them. It was his deal back then.
Right.
And so, again, it's kind of this the Jekyll and Hyde of what this relationship should be and what the president really wants to own up to in this regard.
So let's take a quick call from Tampa, Florida. Mohammed, what's your question here?
Yes. Hi. I've had quite a long time. And what is being talked a lot about in the media is about Julian Assange's hygiene habits more than the role of the U.S. government in arm-twisting the Ecuadorians or the U.K. and influencing the independent states into giving up something outside of their choice or purview. So appreciate if that is discussed.
So, sure.
Thanks,
Mohammed. Can I take that since I mentioned that?
I'd love that, Richard. Richard Engel from Washington, from London. Go right ahead.
Yeah, so there has been quite a bit of attention focused on his personal behavior because that was the reasoning that the Ecuadorians gave. They said after 7 years, they couldn't take him anymore and that he had worn out his welcome. But undoubtedly, there was international pressure on the British government. And if you noticed yesterday, the British authorities went out of their way to say that they made this arrest on behalf of the United States. And quite quickly, there were many in this country who said, many in the United Kingdom, where I am right now, who said, that's appalling. We are not pawns of the Americans. We should have an independent judiciary. We should not be told what to do by Washington. So there
Richard
was
Engel, Richard
quite
Engel,
quickly
give,
a pushback.
Just in 10, 15 seconds, what do you think the likelihood is that the UK doesn't extradite him to the U.S. as requested?
I think it's pretty small right now, frankly. I think they will extradite.
It's going to happen. That's the word from Richard Engel from London. We're joined by Richard, by Vivian Salama, and our own Jack Beatty. We want them to stick around. We want you to stick around. What questions do you have? There's conversations going to focus on all these changes at Homeland Security, ways in which things are staying the same in Israel. Me, I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the news of the week. You can join our conversation. Trump wants more action at the southern border. Israelis give Netanyahu a fifth term as prime minister. What questions do you have? Follow us on Twitter and find us on the Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me today are Vivian Salama of The Wall Street Journal, Richard Engel of NBC News, and On Point's own Jack Beatty. I want to read just a couple of things from listeners. NSTEF posts on the website about Julian Assange. Hacking computer servers and managing document dumps does not make you a journalist nor a hero. Evan W. writes, the problem with Assange isn't that he's a journalist, but that he has a clear agenda. He clearly has a disdain for the United States Democratic Party, whereas WikiLeaks today with this current administration. And of course, there's the official word out of Quito, Ecuador, that basically they were fed up with Assange, including in one report claiming that his 7-year stay was marked by his late night skateboarding, the physical harassment of his caretakers, and even the smearing of his own fecal matter on the walls of the diplomatic mission. Folks, apologies. We're just quoting there. At the same time, I'm sure he would have a different perspective on that. Why don't we turn now to the question of homeland security and immigration. I want to play a clip of what President Trump had to say on Wednesday to kick us off. He offered a sharply negative view of migrants coming into this country from the southern border and said he plans to increase the number of troops there to address illegal migrant crossings.
They wait until the fence is open, the gate is open. They wait at the gates and they kill people and they want to take the truck. A lot of times they don't even want to go to the house. They want to steal the truck.
According to numerous studies and fact-checked by places like the Washington Post, undocumented immigrants are considerably less likely to commit crime than native-born citizens, and immigrants legally in the United States are even less likely to do so. Vivian Salama, we've seen a lot of changes over at the Department of Homeland Security, and it seems related to this. What's going on over there?
Well, over the weekend, on Sunday, Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, went into the White House and ended up resigning, apparently through very mutual agreement. She wanted out and the president wanted her out because for a while now he's felt like she was an ineffective, leader in the immigration crisis. He didn't like how she was handling it. And that wasn't actually a consistent view. Last year, we believed that she was on the outs. A lot of folks at that point in the White House advocating for her, but also a lot of people feeling like she was dropping the ball on the crisis. But she had really kind of clawed her way back into the favor of the White House and the president's view, at least. And she managed to weather the storm for the last couple of months. But with this renewed wave of migrants flowing to the border and the president really kind of returning back to this issue again after the Mueller report was released, it just seemed clear that Kirstjen Nielsen's days were very much numbered. And so when she left, there was a little bit of a domino effect that happened as a result of it. I mean, we saw the Customs and Border Protection head, Kevin McAllenan. He was named acting head. The president is very, very fond of him. He thinks he's been doing a great job. McAllenan is someone who authored a memo last spring that he and two other DHS agencies signed that basically recommended that parents should be included in the Justice Department's zero tolerance plan. Basically prosecuting adults who cross the border, even if they were accompanied by children. And so he's very much a hardliner and someone who shares a lot of the president's views, also shares a lot of Stephen Miller's views. Of course, Stephen Miller being one of the top White House advisors to the president and somebody who's been extremely hawkish on immigration policies in general. And so he's going to be now running the agency, at least in an acting position for now, although folks I speak to at the White House say the president really likes the job he's doing and he definitely is on track. But you've also had a number of other changes as well.
I mean, you've had like the head of ICE. He's forced out the head of Secret Service, although that's not specifically related to what's happening at the southern border. But it seems as though there's a number of important roles that are either unfilled or filled with new acting chiefs, right, in these agencies that help to determine how immigration and various law enforcement policies related to that get enacted. What does it do to have all that instability? And what do you think this does? You mentioned Stephen Miller for the role of Miller, who's a hardliner there at the White House in terms of influencing that policy.
And it's something that my colleague and I have been writing about nonstop since Kirstjen Nielsen left on Sunday, which is ultimately that the White House is essentially taking more of a leading role in the immigration crisis. And whatever it does, with all these people moving around, the destabilization of the Department of Homeland Security, they're essentially being rendered useless. I don't want to say useless because obviously there's so many hardworking men and women, but their ability to call the shots in this crisis is being diminished increasingly so when you have the White House calling the shots. But what we saw in the last couple of weeks, especially, is that DHS was being cut out of the decision-making process. Kirstjen Nielsen, for example, was not looped into the fact that the White House decided to withdraw the nomination of the ICE candidate who you mentioned, Ron Vitiello. She was not looped into a number of other decisions and was essentially having to catch up with whatever the White House was determining was the course of action for the immigration crisis. And we're going to see that increasingly so unless the Department of Homeland Security can kind of get both feet back on the ground and proceed. But right now, the White House is very adamant to at least maintain control so that they can get things on track the way they see it fit.
Jack Beatty, I want you to give us the broad sweep on this, a big view on this, before we move on to the elections in Israel. The latest departures, along with previous vacancies, and I'm reading here from the New York Times, leave the Department of Homeland Security without a permanent secretary, deputy secretary, two undersecretaries, Secret Service director, FEMA director, ICE director, general counsel, citizen and immigration services director, inspector general, chief financial officer, chief privacy officer, no doubt, chief emotional officer, and soon the Customs and Border Protection Commissioner. What does this say about our government, Jack Beatty?
Well, it says that it's working pretty much as Trump designed it to work. During the campaign, Chris Christie spent some of the campaign's money on investigating and vetting and laying out substantial and qualified Republican appointees for all sorts of jobs. Trump, when he discovered that, hit the roof. You're spending my blank, blank money. I want my blank, blank money, he yelled at Christie. And when the election was over, Christie was fired and his list was thrown out. And Trump dealt with the vacancies in two ways. One, he was simply been slow about appointing people to fill top positions. As of November last year, he had failed to put forward a nominee for 139 of the top 700 positions requiring Senate confirmation. In the Department of Agriculture, for example, there was no undersecretary for food, nutrition, etc. But as Michael Lewis points out in his book, The Fifth Risk, lower-level appointees, patronage appointees were made at the Department of Agriculture. Trump appointed, quoting Lewis, a long-haul truck driver, a clerk at AT&T, a gas company meter reader, a country club cabana attendant, a Republican National Committee intern, and my favorite, the owner of a scented candle company. This to the Department of Agriculture. So the sort of decimation of the federal workforce has been implicit in Trumpism pretty much from the start.
Okay, I'd like to take a call now from Sarasota, Florida. Andrew, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yes, sir.
I just wanted to comment on the fact that the Sudan crisis, the revolution going on there, is something that I have only heard about on NPR, on National Public Radio. I haven't seen any coverage on CNN or MSNBC. Even my Google News feed seems to be bereft of coverage on it. And I find that to be disturbing and troubling in that something enormous is going on in an enormous country and we're not talking about it.
Well, thank you for the call, Andrew. I do have the perfect person to talk about that. We, of course, have been covering that thoroughly on NPR. But Richard Engel, the globetrotting chief foreign correspondent from NBC News, with us for the hour today from London. Richard, tell us briefly a little bit about how you guys are approaching this story, and then let's talk a little bit about what actually is happening there.
Sure. Your caller is right. It is getting very little attention, and that is a problem across the globe right now. There is so much attention focused on President Trump, on what's going on in Washington, and what's going on in the United States, that like a bright light, it is casting a lot of other things into shadow. And that is a problem. And what is going on in Sudan is momentous. And I think it's part of a trend we're seeing across the Arab world, where you have a dictator who is then faced by a populist uprising, a movement on the streets. And then amid that chaos, the military sweeps in and grabs power. It's what happened in Egypt. There was a movement against Mubarak. The movement overthrew Mubarak. But then instead of allowing the movement to continue to rule. The military moved in and took it away. And that's what we're seeing right now in Sudan. Omar al-Bashir had been the president, the dictator there for decades. There was an uprising against him, quite a quick one, based in Khartoum. And then the military moved in and says that it will only temporarily hold power, but it has no long-term interests in governing. But usually promises like that are not kept. So, yes, your caller is right. We should be spending more time on it. I'm glad NPR is spending time on it. But in this era where the United States is also probably the biggest international story in the world, other stories have to fight for attention.
So let's dig in for a moment, though, a little bit further about, you know, this is a military overthrow, always troubling. Yet, you know, this is a guy who's ruled for decades. He's been accused of war crimes. If I'm not mistaken, he was accused of genocide in Darfur.
Yes, don't cry for Omar al-Bashir. I don't think he's going to be sorely missed by the people. The idea, however, is that when people went out onto the streets and put their put themselves on the line in order to bring democracy and to bring a better future, only to have the military move in and remove the dictator, which is what the protesters wanted, but then also, from their perspective, removing their dreams.
Can I, there's just one point also.
Vivian Solana, go right ahead, please.
You know, I've been in the room with Omar al-Bashir. I'm a foreign correspondent for 13 years. I've been in the room with this man numerous times. He has traveled multiple countries in the world without any repercussions for over a decade. And he has been indicted multiple times by the International Criminal Court on genocide, crimes against humanity, a number of different crimes. 300,000 people died on his watch in Darfur in 2003 alone. So, you know, again, like Richard says, you don't cry for Omar al-Bashir, but you also, it really raises questions about the international legal system where this man has basically been able to travel, granted in friendly countries, a number of countries in Africa and the Middle East, but he's been able to go into these countries and not face arrest. It was only really in recent years that, he almost was arrested in South Africa, and there was a lot of building pressure against him that he started to really kind of face the gavel that his time was up. But until then, it wasn't the case. And so, it is an issue. And I, mind you, I do not work for CNN and I do not have a relationship with them, but I actually did see a couple of reports yesterday about it. I mean, it is a big deal, but I definitely agree with you that it should get a lot more attention because it really raises a lot of questions about how we operate as an international legal system.
A couple comments from our website, Finance Phil. Don't worry, Sudan, South Sudan has oil. We'll be hearing about South Sudan and its neighbor to the north very soon. A little cynical note. Hello Kitty 0580, at least posted that way, says, yes, it's great that al-Bashir has been ousted, but Sudan has no history of practicing democracy. I'm not holding my breath. The military is going to hold on to power because that's what it does. And also, Bashir is not going to face any of the international criminal charges against him. I want to turn now to elections in Israel, a more peaceful democratic exercise of power. In this case, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appeared to hold on to power after elections earlier this week. He is set to serve a record-setting fifth term in office. Here is Netanyahu delivering his victory speech on Wednesday.
I intend to work quickly to establish a stable national government. I want to make it clear it will be a right-wing government. But I intend to be the Prime Minister of all Israeli citizens, right or left, Jews and non-Jews alike, all Israeli citizens.
Richard Engel, a different note than it seemed to me that Netanyahu struck during the campaign. How is he able to pull this off?
So this is an interesting interesting candidate, an interesting time in Israeli history. Ben Netanyahu, if you remember, throughout his campaign was leaning very much to the right. He was trying all he could to embrace even some of the fringe elements in the Israeli electorate. He was under a lot of pressure. He was under investigations. There was a sort of a Trump-like scandal that has been surrounding him, where he's been accused of taking bribes in exchange for giving favors to a media company.
You'd think that'd be kind of the death notice of any prime ministerial ambitions, right?
And well, really, I mean, you're living in the United States right now. Is that
point taken?
He just eked by, but he did get through it. And now in that speech, he's. What sounded like he's dialing back a little bit. He said, yes, right in the beginning, and he got applause, as you heard, this is going to be a right-wing government. But then he reached out and said, I want to be the prime minister for all Israelis, Jews, non-Jews, left-wing, right-wing. That's not exactly the tone he was striking during the campaign as he was beating back these allegations of corruption and as he was trying to bring in as many people as he could, particularly on the right, and get them out to cast votes.
Jack Beatty, very briefly, about 30 seconds, but is this now Bibi Netanyahu's Israel? Is this now sort of the vision of what we understand Israel to be? That is a pretty hard line, at least rhetorically and at times in policy toward Palestinians and towards the state security.
Well, he actually mentioned annexing more settlements on the West Bank, which, of course, could touch off another intifada and in any case would put the dream of a two-state solution further away. It's already fairly remote. And all of this, his campaign with unprecedented help from his friend President Trump.
A close connection indeed. You're hearing Jack Beatty, Richard Engel, Vivian Salama talk to us about the week's news. We're going to be talking about the attorney general. Bill Barr says he's turning his attention to the investigators of Trump rather than the investigation. What questions do you have? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're going behind the headlines of the big stories this week and want to touch on a few that we can't delve into too deeply. In the state of Ohio, Governor Mike DeWine signed what is called the Heartbeat Bill yesterday. It will ban abortions after a fetal heartbeat is detected, typically around 6 weeks. That's often before many women know that they are actually pregnant. The bill is expected to take effect in July. Critics promise a strong court challenge. My guess is that will be making headlines for some weeks and months to come. And President Donald Trump's older sister, federal appellate judge Marianne Trump Barry, has retired. And by doing so, she's ended a judicial investigation into whether she broke judicial conducts by committing tax fraud, according to a still unreleased court filing. Because Barry retired, the investigation was automatically closed. What was amazing to me about this story was the New York Times said in print, without qualification, it involved fraud. A pretty astonishing turn of events for the president's sister. You can join the conversation. What questions do you have about the attorney general's moves? What do you want to know about the U.S. stance toward Iran? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest this hour, Vivian Salama of the Wall Street Journal. She's a White House reporter there and also a veteran foreign correspondent. We have Richard Engel, the chief foreign correspondent for NBC News, and of course, our own political analyst, Jack Beatty. I want to start with a couple of clips setting up the Attorney General's week. Attorney General Bill Barr appeared before lawmakers twice this week. He was asked why he wanted to do something that President Trump has called for quite a long time, and that is to investigate the origins of the Russia investigation. Here's what Attorney General Barr had to say.
Generation I grew up in, which was the Vietnam War period, you know, people were all concerned about spying on anti-war people and so forth by the government. And there were a lot of rules put in place to make sure that there's an adequate basis before before our law enforcement agencies get involved in political surveillance.
So Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire, a Democrat, then pointedly asked the attorney general precisely what he was getting at.
You're not suggesting, though, that spying occurred.
I don't. I guess you could. I think there's a spying did occur. Yes, I think spying did occur.
That occasioned a pretty sharp comeback from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She questioned his independence from the president on Wednesday. Pelosi said Barr's pursuit of Trump's claims about spying during the 2016 campaign undermines his position as the nation's top law enforcement officer.
On that subject of the Judiciary Committee, let me just say how very, very dismaying and disappointing that the chief law enforcement officer of our country is going off the rails yesterday and today. He is the Attorney General of the United States of America, not the Attorney General of Donald Trump.
That's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi with some sharp words there for the nation's chief law enforcement officer. Vivian Salama, give us some perspective here. What course is Bill Barr charting?
Well, you know, this is since the Mueller investigation. Of course, we're only about a month into Bill Barr's second tenure as the attorney general. Of course, he held that position during the Bush administration. He has been getting a lot of criticism since his 4-page letter summarizing the Mueller report came out, because a number of people believed him to be partisan, you know, responding in a partisan manner. Obviously, he has already come out and criticized, expressed a critical view of the Mueller investigation. And so there was good reason for folks to raise a concern about that. However, even going into this hearing, you know, this hearing, mind you, was an appropriations hearing to talk about the Department of Justice's budget. But of course, we were anticipating that Democrats would not let him off the hook and use the opportunity to really grill him on a number of issues, including the Mueller report. And so when the comments about the spying came out, obviously Democrats started to beat the partisan war drums in terms of their belief, again, that he was speaking on behalf of Donald Trump and not the administration. And this has sort of been a pattern now for the last couple of weeks that he's been in office. And obviously, given how the tenure of the first Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, went, and the fact that he, A, recused himself from the Russia investigation, and B, would constantly criticize, He tried to keep a distance, essentially, from what the rest of the government was saying in terms of the fact that the Russians did hack the elections, and there were concerns about that. President Trump, of course, being a little bit more reluctant to come out and lash out at the Russians in terms of their activities in 2016. And so, so far, a lot of criticism about Attorney General Barr's approach to this, saying that he needs to be essentially the top law enforcement official of this country, take an unpartisan, objective approach to dealing with these legal matters, and of course Democrats especially believing that he's not doing that so far.
President Trump has been pretty upfront about his desire for the people who launched investigations of Trump World to be themselves investigations for their motives, for their behavior. He spoke with reporters in the White House South Lawn Wednesday and said he spoke directly with the Attorney General about tracing the origins of that inquiry that exonerated him of colluding with Russia.
This was an attempted coup. This was an attempted takedown of a president. And we beat them. We beat them. So the Mueller report, when they talk about obstruction, we fight back. And you know why we fight back? Because I knew how illegal this whole thing was.
So, Jack Beatty, you know, the question of spying has been a meme on the right. There's been this notion that people were spied on. I believe in one case somebody was surveillance was commenced after he had left the campaign. So the campaign was not technically spied upon, although some of the email exchange was captured by federal investigators. People have said that it's not true that Obama, as Trump once claimed, wiretapped Trump Tower. And there are these inquiries going on, right? Inspector General at the Justice Department, and I believe the U.S. Attorney for Utah is looking into this. But why wouldn't Bill Barr, in a sense, you know, is there not some reason for Bill Barr to say, let me get a hold of this and let's find out exactly what happened so I can clear the people of the Justice Department if nothing wrong was done?
Yes. And if he had just said that and avoided that incendiary word spying, that might have been all right. You know, he really went full Fox in using that word.
That's a great phrase.
He really gave fleet legs to the conspiracy theories that you were talking about, that behind everything, behind the dossier, behind the investigation, was a sort of cabal, a plot from people in the FBI connected to Hillary Clinton to somehow swing the election. Well, wait now. How does the logic work? We know Russia was – it doesn't have logic. Somehow Hillary was – the Democrats were subverting themselves. Leave out logic. And to have – you know, Secretary Nielsen is a cautionary example for Attorney General Barr. She implemented a cruel policy for the president, family separation. She will forever bear that onus of the caged children, 2,700 families separated from their children. And she lied about it for the president. And now here we have Mr. Barr seemingly willing to go the extra mile to give credence to one of the president's wildest themes. You know, it's what Charlie Sykes, the conservative blogger, says, Trumpism is the bonfire of reputations.
The bonfire of reputations, indeed. So I want to let's actually take a call now, I think, from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Nicole is calling. Nicole, weigh in here. What are your thoughts about this?
I was just wondering, this whole thing about Barr and the spying thing, isn't that the same thing Devin Nunes was doing on the Intelligence Committee in the House when he was in charge? How is that different?
Let me throw that to Vivian Salama. You know, Devin Nunes was when the Republicans controlled the House, and thank you for your call, Nicole. When the Republicans controlled the House of Representatives, Devin Nunes, a Democrat from around Fresno in California, was that chair of that committee and seemed to run a lot of interference for Trump, but he also went on offense some, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, you know, Devin Nunes was at the heart of a lot of controversies in the early days of the Trump administration because of he was believed to have come into the NSC and have viewed certain classified documents by someone that someone essentially at the NSC let him in to view some classified documents. There was a lot of controversy about why he would A, have wanted to access those particular documents, and B, how he got in there in the first place, because it's a very closed environment. And so he his name has come up a lot. But you know, the argument that a lot of people would make is that Devin Nunes is, at the end of the day, a partisan lawmaker. The role of the attorney general, while it is obviously a politically appointed job, that person is essentially expected to maintain some level of objectivity. And so that really is at the heart of the dispute, where a lot of Democrats, especially, pointing to William Barr and saying, you know, this is not what your job entails. You are basically violating the code that you strike by becoming attorney general.
Although I'm always reminded of the thing a former CIA official once told me, which was he's like, when you turn over the rock, you'll never know what you'll see wriggling
right
underneath.
Right.
Let's turn now to the question of Iran. On Monday, the Trump administration designated Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps as a foreign terrorist organization. The IRGC is a powerful arm of Iran's military. This is the very first time the U.S. has named a part of another nation's government as a foreign terrorist group. And there was a lot of attention within the U.S. administration for that. Here's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking at a press conference about the labeling.
With this designation, the Trump administration is simply recognizing a basic reality. The IRGC will take its rightful place on the same list as terror groups it supports: Lebanese Hezbollah, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, Hamas, Khatib Hezbollah, among others, all of which are already designated as foreign terrorist organizations.
Richard Engel, talk to us a little bit about the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, its role, and what the implications are of this designation.
So the Rev Guard, as it's usually known, is a very, very powerful force inside Iran. It has official governmental roles. It is a power that controls a lot of movements on the streets. It is sometimes called the real power behind the Ayatollahs who run the Iranian theocracy. So it is a massively influential and wealthy part of the Iranian government. And what I think we're seeing right here is the Trump administration turning up the screws on Iran. And it's been doing this for some time. If you remember, President Trump, after threatening to do it time and time again and offering small delays and extensions, finally pulled out of the Iran nuclear deal that was negotiated by the Obama administration. But that was a very controversial move. Other signatories on that, mostly European countries, didn't pull out of the Iran nuclear deal because they said that Iran wasn't violating the deal. So the U.S. unilaterally said, we're no longer going to be part of this agreement. And that agreement was a quid pro quo. In exchange for slowing down and stopping many, many parts of its nuclear program, more business and more commerce would be allowed to be conducted with Iran. That was the basic deal. The U.S. pulled out, but other countries did not. By adding these sanctions, it is one more nail in a coffin that the U.S. is trying to nail shut on Iran. They are trying to make it, this administration is trying to make it very difficult for Iran to continue trading with those partners that did not pull out of the deal. So you're seeing them add more sanctions, designating more groups, adding one more nail at a time to try to kill the deal and to make others who stayed in the deal not be able to continue to work with Iran.
Vivian, you come at this from the perspective of not only covering the White House, but having been a foreign correspondent in the Middle East. That said, within the White House, was this seen as a way to play to sort of factions of the Trump's base that is really hardcore against Iran? Or is this seen as, hey, this is going to be really effective. This will do great things for us.
A little bit of both. So remember now that President Trump's national security advisor is John Bolton, and he has basically dedicated the recent years of his career to countering the threat of Iran. He's extremely hawkish on Iran. Years ago, he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times before he became a national security advisor that essentially said, if you want to stop Iran, bomb Iran. And so he's always been extremely tough on Tehran and wanting to limit its influence across the Middle East. And so, this was just another step, as Richard said. Certainly, I was with the president last week at the border, and then we went to Las Vegas for the Republican Jewish Coalition, which is a big conference. And while the decision hadn't been announced about the IRGC yet, he was definitely playing to the crowd and talking about all the tough measures that he has taken so far with regard to cracking down on Iran's influence. And let me tell you, people were jumping up on their chairs, like shouting and waving, and they just loved it. And so for sure, there's definitely an element of it where he believes that his base will respond well to those issues. And they do for a lot of Republicans. A lot of Republicans do genuinely see the rise of Iranian influence as an issue. Also, the fact that the president has a very firm relationship with the Arab Gulf states, and the Arab Gulf states also want to counter the threat of Iran as much as Israel does and as much as a lot of Americans do in terms of his base. And so he's also very much delivering to their needs because he's also asking a lot of them with regard to any kind of investment opportunities and other issues in the Middle East.
And to take care of your needs, listeners, we want to touch on a story we've been following a lot. The European Union has announced it's going to extend the deadline for Brexit, for the British to get out of the European Union until October 31st. They're avoiding a crash out by the British government, which came with the risk of a lot of peril. I want to thank Vivian Salama, White House reporter for The Wall Street Journal and author of a new children's book called The Long Journey Home, about a young boy fleeing Syria with his family. Vivian, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Also, Richard Engel, chief foreign correspondent for NBC News. New episode of On Assignment with Richard Engel airs Sunday night on MSNBC. Richard, thanks.
My pleasure.
And Jack Beatty. Have a good weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
You can join our conversation online. We'd like you to do so. Our executive producer, Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet? Is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits, so you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.